We're back, colleagues. We resume with Adwoad Mpofu and Ms. Mviane. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to round off. There's an issue, which another red herring issue bandied about by those who want to, I think, distract us from the real issues. And this has to do with Mr. Pillay, specifically. Unfortunately, Mr. Pillay is also being shielded from coming to finish his cross-examination. Apparently, since he was not available last year, he's not available for the rest of his life, even though he's the one who volunteered to make a public submission. But be that as it may, Mr. Pillay, you'll remember that one of the issues that you, which I would have loved to question him on, if he ever comes back, was this issue about his qualifications, correct?
Yes.
Now, this whole thing is just distracted into some issue about a nonsensical issue about a matric certificate and so on. But the point really, if we go back to, are we still at the letter, Tepo? Sorry, we're going backwards this time. At 3.10, yes. 3.10, the allegation from Mr. Shivambu or from the complainant was that it had nothing to do with matric or anything at this stage. Since Mr. Pillay was appointed to the position of Deputy SARS Commissioner and subsequently as SARS Commissioner, whilst he did not possess the necessary qualifications for the position. Right?
Yes.
Positions, sorry. And you, at 8.6, again, when I say you, I mean you and the public protector, then decided that one of the issues you are going to deal with in phase one is that issue, and you phrase it like that. The allegation that Mr. Pillay was appointed to the position of Deputy SARS Commissioner and subsequently SARS Commissioner while he did not possess the necessary qualification for the position, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. And then if you go to, sorry, go to now 14.5.4. This is, bearing in mind now, this letter is actually to Mr. Pillay. So again, he's being given an opportunity to refute this, that he did not have the necessary qualifications. And while we're going there, let me just say that Mr. Pillay seems to be the elusive Mr. Pillay who doesn't want to come back here. Seems to be a unique species in South Africa. Firstly, he got a retirement, which was not a retirement, and got paid a taxpayer's account. You were not involved in that particular investigation of the Pillay pension scandal, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
But now here again, he's another first. I think he must be the first person or the only person even in the future to be a SARS commissioner armed only with a matric, if that. But anyway, the point is that at 14.5.4, you say that SARS in their response stated did not dispute that Mr. Pillay did not have a degree and that he possessed a matric certificate. So even on the version that you sent to him, you were assuming for the purposes of argument that he did not have a degree but possessed a matric certificate. You see that?
Yes.
Yes. Now, somewhere in the report, and the public protector will deal with this when she gives evidence. For now, let's assume that it's some mistake. But somewhere in the report, it's suggested that he does not have a matric certificate. And then everything else is now pinned on that mistake to distract us from the fact that even if he had a matric, he would not qualify for... Yes. To distract us from the fact that even if he had a matric, really a matric certificate cannot be qualification to become the commissioner of SARS or even the deputy. And that 14.5.8, sorry.
I don't want to interrupt you, but would it assist you if I tell you where the reference was?
Of the
matric.
Matric. Yeah, it would assist me. It's page 98.
It's paragraph
5.6.26. Yes, I've got that. Yes, thank you. What's the fuller reference?
I think it's 3.13 para 5.6.26.
Yes, can you go there, Sir Poachers? Thank you. Just for completion. Okay, while she's looking, then I'll use this to address the chair on this. Chair, this reference we did deal with this briefly with Mr. Pillay, though we didn't complete it. It's about this, the issue of whether or not Mr. Pillay was being favored by Mr. Godan because of their history in the struggle and all that. And we will argue at the end that even the most heroic experts in the struggle cannot give you qualifications to be the commissioner of SARS armed with a matric. Otherwise, the many people who were involved in the struggle and they're working in places where they're qualified. Are you finding it, Sepa? Yeah, it's in the report which we referred to earlier. Okay, actually it's fine. We can do without it. Okay, you've got it. 5.6.26. Yeah, thank you. Yes. Now, here, Chair, is, as I say, for now, until the public protector comes, we'll put this in context. Let's assume that this was a faux pas or a misprint or a mistake or whatever. But this is what now is being latched on. It says, SARS and Mr. Godan considered that Mr. Pillay did not possess a degree, qualification, nor a matric certificate. Now, we know that Mr. Godin considered, both Mr. Godin and Mr. Pillay did concede that he did not have a degree, correct? Your mic is not on.
Sorry about that. It was switched off when Advocate Bauer was speaking.
Okay.
No, I was just saying that, yes, it's correct that they did concede that he did not have a degree. Hmm. I was just stating that SAR, in their response, stated that there was no formal qualification.
And, okay, good. Yeah. And I think that's, okay, we'll get to that. All right, I didn't know that you know that. That's the part that I was going to say. I was saying it was going to be explained by the public.
Oh, by the people.
Yes.
Sorry.
But, okay, no, that's good. It's even better if it's explained by both of you. So the SARS considered that he had no formal qualification, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And that would include the matric or anything?
From my assessment, yes.
Yes. But so the mistake in that sentence would be to ascribe that concession to Mr. Godin, because in fairness, Mr. Godin only considered that he did not have tertiary education. I think that's what the words he used. Take it from me.
Okay.
Correct?
Okay, correct.
Yeah. And Mr. Pillay himself also could not be accused of making that second concession. He considered that he did not have a degree, but he claimed that he had a matric. That, at least he said that to the public protector. That's now common cause.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So the point I want to make here is that instead of running with this metric thing, which has, I say, the red herring, all these people, SARS, Mr. Godin, Mr. Pillay, Mr. XYZ, everyone alive in South Africa accepts that the Mr. Pillay did not possess a degree. Okay?
Correct.
Yes. Now, when you asked SARS for, or anybody, let me put it this way, have you ever seen a matric certificate of Mr. Pillay?
No, I have not.
Yes. And when he comes back here, if he ever dares to come back, we will ask him to bring that matric certificate. But until then, we'll assume that he does have that certificate. Okay?
Okay, noted.
Right. Now, so the point I simply want to make is that that whole matric thing just was used as a distraction. The gist of what you were investigating is what is stated, which I read to you at 3.10 and 8.6, namely that Mr. Pillay was given those positions without a suitable qualification.
That's correct, yes.
Yes. And if it's framed like that and not use this red herring story of the matric, was that allegation substantiated?
Yes, from the evidence that we had before, it was substantiated.
Yes. And we know that there was some mumbo jumbo that was given as the reasons for that. One of them was something called strategic feat or goodness of feat or whatever. Yes. Some method that makes you to overlook people's lack of education.
Yes, goodness of feat.
Yes. And then the other one was struggle credentials. That's the Mr. Godin said Mr. Pillay deserved that position despite not having any formal education, or any formal qualification according to SARS, or any tertiary education according to Mr. Godin, because he was he had made a good contribution to the struggle. Is that correct?
Yes, not so many words, but he also said he was a long-serving member of the public service.
Yes. Mm. Yes, true. And it contributed to the transformation of SARS and that
yes.
kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. All right. So the reality is that we had somebody who, at best for him, was qualified with a matric certificate from 1970 at some place, and which is indistinct in Benoni somewhere. Or we had someone who had no formal qualification, at least that could be proved by SARS, being the commissioner of SARS of South Africa.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And the court found that this is, that the public protector was disingenuous because of that mistake, of that suggestion of conflating SARS with Mr. Godin, that said that he did not have a matric certificate, correct?
I'm sure. Is that what the court said?
I'm shocked too. Yes, that's okay. What the court said. The court said, so I'll find it just now. And maybe let me ask my I'll come back to it, Chair, to the reference, yes. But yeah, I'm just paraphrasing what the court said effectively, that or rather it went on this issue of the matric certificate and the fact that Mr. Pillay had told the public protector in a meeting that he had a matric certificate. So how could she put that sentence that you put up there, and therefore she was disingenuous and so on and so on.
Okay, noted.
Right. And well, that went up. It's not just this court, to be fair to the court of Mr. Bagwa, of Judge Bagwa, that went up to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and they rejected any attempt to appeal, and it went to the Constitutional Court. They also found nothing wrong with the judgment, or at least there were no prospects of success, according to those courts, without any. So it's 3, 5, 11, about 19 judges or 20 judges who endorsed that view. But and in fact, what was said is that you and the public protector and other people were deserving of censure, punitive costs, and personal costs for even daring to suggest that Mr. Pillay, among other things, Mr. Pillay could possibly not have been the right person with his credentials or lack thereof, educationally speaking, of heading our revenue services. Um, All right. Then we go to yeah, this letter of yours is too long. At least we're now around page 63, chapters. You'll be happy to know of the 66-page letter. I think we've covered this issue about you saying the, it's 16.2. Regarding whether SARS failed to follow correct procurement processes in the procurement of intelligence equipment, which the intelligence units utilize for gathering intelligence, and if so, whether such conduct amounts to maladministration. You found that that is established. We've already covered that, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
In 16.2.1, the allegation that SARS failed to follow the proper procurement processes in the procurement of intelligence equipment with the intelligence units utilized for gathering intelligence is substantiated. Okay, we've covered that. Then the next one is 16.3, regarding whether SARS failed to follow proper recruitment processes in the appointment of employees who work for the intelligence unit. We also covered that. Yeah, that was also substantiated, correct?
Yes, it was.
But notably, 16.3.5, which we would like to highlight for the committee, it says the apparent denial of Mr. Godin of any involvement in participation in the recruitment process of one or more of the unit's employees is improbable. The Sikakane report and the Jean Revelle dossier confirm that Mr. Godin played a role in the recruitment of Mr. Van Lochenberg. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
And you presented this to them for refutation, correct?
Yes.
And then 16.3.6, you say, I've also noted that Mr. Mahashula's denial of the existence of the unit and recruitment of employees thereof is a misrepresentation. Mr. Mahashula, at the time, the members of the unit were transferred within SARS to form CBU, and the appointment of external staff was the Chief Operations Officer, Corporate Services. He approved the memorandum submitted by Mr. Pillay relating to employees to the newly formed unit. So you give the basis for disbelieving Mr. Mahashula, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then the punchline is 16.3.8, which I'll read to the record. It says, the conduct of Mr. Godin and Mr. Pillay in approving the memo for the establishment and invariable recruitment of staff for the intelligence unit in the manner described is improper, and thus amounted to improper conduct as envisaged in section 182(1) of the constitution and maladministration as envisaged in section 6(4) Roman 1 of the Public Protector Act. That was the concrete finding, correct?
Yes.
Then regarding whether the intelligence, 16.4, regarding whether the intelligence unit carried out irregular and unlawful intelligence operation, and if so, whether such conduct constitutes maladministration. That is that whole debate about whether it amounts to interception and Mr. Duval and what have you. You found that was substantiated as well, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Then finally, at 16.5, regarding whether Mr. Pillay was appointed to the position of Deputy SARS Commissioner and subsequently a SARS Commissioner whilst he did not possess the necessary qualifications for the position, and if so, whether such conduct amounts to maladministration. Again, there's no mention of matric here or anything. It's simply whether he did not possess the necessary qualifications for the positions, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then 16.5.1, you say the allegation that Mr. Pillay was appointed in the position of Deputy SARS Commissioner and subsequently the SARS Commissioner while he did not possess the necessary qualifications is substantiated. Correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair. The part that you said you were shocked by, and I said I shared your shock, is to be found in the judgment at paragraph 227. Oh. Sorry, Tepa. It's page 4093 of that bundle of judgments. This is what our judges said. Panel C, yes, I'm told.
Okay, paragraph.
It starts at 227, but I want to read 229. I think that's a special one. Okay, the charge says, firstly, there's no requirement, I'll read it, we'll catch up with it. There's no requirement that only the holder of a degree can be appointed as deputy commissioner of SARS or hold an acting appointment as a commissioner. Secondly, there's no rational basis for the conclusion as Mr. Pillay's qualification for appointment as deputy commissioner were clearly taken into account and it was found that he was suitably qualified for the appointment. What the public protector presumably meant by her statement is that the fact that Mr. Pillay does not possess a degree was not taken into consideration. But in as much as the possession of a degree is not a precondition for the appointment of deputy commissioner, the public protector's reasoning is fallacious. And then it says from 233. No, sorry, let's start at 232. This is the revolutionary consideration. So there are three difficulties, whatever. Firstly, it is doubtful that SARS would have stated that Mr. Pillay did not matriculate, as that would have been a false statement, says the judges. As Mr. Pillay matriculated in 1970, having completed his secondary school studies at Mierbank High School, did you ever get such information, such proof of that?
No, we didn't even have his CV. We got SARS, couldn't find.
Yeah. Definitely. And then the judge says, secondly, nowhere in Minister Kodan's affidavit is this stated that Mr. Pillay does not possess a matric certificate. That will concede. It was only SARS who said no qualification, correct?
Yes.
And then what Minister Kodan recorded was that quote, Mr. Pillay, like many other South Africans who dedicated their lives to the struggle against apartheid, does not have any tertiary qualification. So this is what I was referring to when I was saying one of the reasons given for employing him in such a sophisticated position was his dedication to the struggle. Correct?
Yes, apparently.
Thirdly, the statement that contradicted to the evidence the public protector had in her possession at the time of the release of the report. Did the public protector have such evidence contradictory to the lack of qualifications?
We did not have a matric certificate. We did not have his qualifications. So which evidence are they talking about?
I don't know. Then at 233, it says somewhere in the middle there, for no apparent reason, the public protector disregarded his evidence. In fact, she doubled down on this issue by finding that Mr. Pillay possessed neither a tertiary qualification nor a matric certificate. And then this is the what the public protector says, which is rejected by the judges in explanation, Chair, at 4, paragraph 233. This is what she said in her affidavit. It is denied that the public protector made a malicious slay against Mr. Pillay. The issue of the matrix certificates could have simply been resolved by Mr. Pillay providing that information to the public protector when he was asked to give information about his qualifications. He failed to do so, as SARS fails to answer the questions on Mr. Pillay's qualifications. In any event, there's nothing in the report of the public protector to support the contention that she concluded that Mr. Pillay had no matric. And that's the passage that we read earlier, which attributed that to SARS and to Mr. Godin wrongly in Mr. Godin's place, but not to the public protector. What the public protector said was that it was not denied by Godin or SARS that Mr. Pillay did not possess a tertiary education, education including matric. So here it was being explained in simple English that the public protector did not say in her report that Mr. Pillay does not have a matric. She simply said Godin and SARS did not deny that he did not possess a tertiary education, including a matric. You understand the difference between those two things?
Yes, I do.
Congratulations. Okay. Then the 234, it says, counsel for the public protector, in addition, submitted during admin that Mr. Pillay, quote, in his long and verbose affidavit dated 14 April 2019, Mr. Pillay does not disclose what his qualifications are, except that he has some experience, which amongst others come to the fact that he was in the struggle for the liberation of South Africa. And then here's the punchline, which brings us here to this room today. The contention in the answering affidavit and submissions made on behalf of the public protector that the public protector made no finding that Mr. Pillay had no matric and that Mr. Pillay did not provide the information about his qualification when he was asked to do so is disingenuous. Say the charges. Was that contention disingenuous that firstly, that the public protector herself made no finding that Mr. Pillay had no matric. Compared to what I've written, I read to you earlier, do you accept that is not what she said?
No. I believe it might have been misinterpreted here, but the report states that there was no evidence, if I can summarize, of Mr. Pillay having a formal qualification. So that includes a degree and, in argument, a matric.
Yes. And then the second one that is called disingenuous is that Mr. Pillay did not provide the information about his qualification when he was asked to do so. Did he provide any evidence to support his claim of the matric?
No.
And then this is the last part. It says, the conclusion that Mr. Pillay had no degree and no matric was central to the public protector's finding that Mr. Pillay was not qualified to be appointed deputy commissioner. Is that true? Let's assume for a minute there had been a matric certificate. Would you have concluded differently? Would you have concluded that now that means he's qualified to be commissioner for SARS?
No. Because besides the qualification, the manner in which the SARS went about, because in the report we first started with the deputy commissioner position and stated that it was a new position and it had to be properly created within the organogram, if I can use that word, and Mr. Godin had not done that. So, and in not doing that, that means that the duties were not properly identified, the competencies were not properly identified. When it then came to the appointment to commissioner, SARS claimed to have used the goodness of fit model, which then they said only identified people based on their competencies in relation to leadership and et cetera. Qualifications was not really a big thing for them, and their experience within SARS, et cetera. So the finding made by the PP was based on that, and not necessarily the metric. In when we quoted the Constitution here, the fact that, yes, he might not have a degree or have enough experience at SARS, but when we looked at other adverts for the position of commissioner, they require a degree now. So to not require a degree, it really didn't sit well. And we couldn't have made another finding, I believe.
Yeah. And then here's the coup de grace. Apart from it being disingenuous, based on all this, what I've just described, it says, accordingly, at the time of the report, the public protector well knew that Mr. Billet has a matric certificate. Is that factually true?
I was not in the meeting that the judges claim is where the PP learned of Mr. Billet's matric status, or if any.
Okay, yeah. That's fine. Now, assume that in that meeting, he did claim to have a matric certificate. Mm. I'm asking you about this statement. Accordingly, at the time of the record, the public record well knew that Mr. Pillay has a matric certificate. In other words, she either had seen it or she was convinced of that fact. Is that true, factually?
No, that is incorrect.
And then it says, her conclusion in the report that Mr. Pillay does not hold even the basic qualification, notwithstanding the fact that on 25 March she accepted that this was the matter of public record and was within her knowledge, is astounding. Well, apart from that adjective, is the what preceded that she accepted it, that he has a matric, to your knowledge, is that true?
No. On the 14th of March,
I accept that you didn't know the date.
I did not.
Yeah. And then it says, we submit that this further demonstrates that the public protector closed her mind and adopted the process of irrational reasoning. I rest my case. So that's the kind of thing that this committee is supposed to inquire into and make up its own mind. And it will have to find, I suppose, the public protector is going to testify for herself, whether A, she has ever seen such a matric certificate, B, whether she ever accepted that it exists, and C, even if it existed, whether that would be sufficient qualification to be commissioner for SARS. Then it comes to the conclusion, and Chair, I know this letter, we've now come to the page 64 to 66. And then I want to just read the gist of it, and it would be the same. The one to SARS, Mr. Godin, would also be the same. Say, I hereby afford you, Mr. Pillay, the opportunity to comment under oath to the above terms of this notice, the 65 pages. You are requested to respond to the above as within 10 working days as per 24D. I also invite you to state under oath that you have declared or provided to my office all relevant information, documents, any other evidence relevant to this complaint. You may engage with the public protector investigation team through the chief investigator, good governance, and so on, or forward all the inquiries to Mr. Kabinde, that was the public protector's personal assistant, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Should you be in agreement with the intended findings, it will be necessary to issue a report that simply indicates SARS' intention to remedy the maladministration and improper conduct referred to in the report. However, should you have evidence contradicting the evidence in my position relating to this matter, kindly forward same to my office. Please take note that the appropriate remedial actions will only be taken once an investigation is completed, having taken into account your response, if any, to my preliminary findings herein. Should you fail to respond or contradict or rebut my preliminary findings, my investigation will be finalized and remedial action taken in terms of 182(1)(c) of the Constitution, and my report will therefore be published in terms of Section 1 of the Public Protector Act. Further, take notice that in terms of Section 7(2), the contents of this notice are confidential and no person may disclose them without my authorization. In terms of 11, they are not entitled to access the records and documents in my possession during the course of my investigation. In terms of Section 11 of the Public Protector Act, any person who contravenes the provisions of Section 7(2) is guilty of an offence which is punishable by a fine not exceeding 40,000 or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 12 months or both such fine. Kind regards, Advocate Busisiwe Mkhwebane, Public Protector, 5 June 2019, page 66. That was then the sum total of what was presented to, and I think the one to Mr. Godan was 71 pages, so we're not going to go there, sir, after this. But the point really of us going through this is to show the exact, as I say, I mean, I'm not being funny about this. I have never seen a letter this long and with so much technical detail. So can you maybe take the commission, the inquiry into what is involved in the compilation of something like this, with all this detail and this act and that act and this charge and that charge and this list of equipment and what have you, list of names, in order to give the person an opportunity to defend themselves. From someone like you now, because you really, the letter originates from you, the public protector approves or disapproves or changes it here and there. We all know the story by now. But what does it take, the kind of blood and sweat that it takes for you to put something like this together?
Firstly, the most important part before you start even drafting is to analyze the documents that you've received that are before you, to see what they say, if they are relevant, you know how when to put them in, and if they're irrelevant, you know where they go. So each issue then is separated as in the report. The allegation is separated. All the evidence relating to each allegation has to be in that allegation. And then you draft, you summarize what is on paper and put it to make it read well to the whoever will be the reader. So that will include summarizing your evidence, noting the important parts of the evidence which deserve to be in the report. Once you go through that for each issue, your writing style will be different. Others prefer to first incorporate the evidence in all the issues and then only go into the legislation. My style is a bit different because I like to first analyze the legislation for each issue, so that it will be easier to remember the evidence whilst applying it to the law, so that you can come to a conclusion. That will then happen for each and every issue until we get to the findings. You then make findings based on the law and the facts. And now we put in the remedial action, but at this point in time, we had not put in the remedial action in the Section 7(9). Once you're done with your draft and you check and double check again, you then submit it to your chief investigator. Your chief investigator will make inputs, make changes if necessary, include information that he or she also remembers, send it back to you for incorporation. That can happen for a couple of times, sometimes 5, sometimes 10.
No way.
Depending on what is missing. If certain information is identified as missing, you would then go back to how do you obtain that information. So if it's necessary to go back to the department or a particular individual, you'll then write to them again or request a meeting, etc. Once that is done, it will go through the 7 stages that you talked about, or 5 stages. And each person will then, the 5 stages will be your EMs, your ACOO, until it finally reaches the PP. And in before reaching the PP, it's back and forth with incorporating inputs of comments made, inputs made, until the final draft is then approved that it is ready. Usually, by the, in this case, it was the chief investigator. And then it was submitted to the PP. PP also reads it, goes through it and makes inputs, sends it back on things that she wants it incorporated, or we will have a meeting to discuss the Section 7-9 and maybe if she doesn't understand something, why a certain conclusion was reached, etc. So in all of these instances, everyone applies their mind until the final product is done and it's signed and sent. Once it's sent, we await responses to the Section 7-9. Once we receive the responses, we go through the responses and really go through the responses to see that, to make sure that the arguments that we have made or put forward or the conclusions that we have come to or potentially might come to are addressed by the respondent. Once that is done, we then incorporate the responses in line with the particular allegation. So we won't just dump your response in an allegation that's not relevant to it. In this instance, there were a lot of, like you were saying, the allegations of bias and accusations of non-application of the 6-9. So you find positions, places to put that in, and then you address it if necessary. Responses that are rude, or we would consider rude, maybe saying something not nice about the public protector, we'll note, because if it doesn't relate specifically to the allegations, we can't be having a debate with you on the Section 7-9 or on the report. So once those are incorporated and all of those are considered, a final report is then produced. If your response or negated our potential findings, and then once we go through your evidence, we do make a finding. Like, for example, you stated that you then provided the slip for the water bottle. We cannot then make an adverse finding against you if you've provided us with evidence that shows that the allegation is unproved. It will be removed from the final report. If the evidence is not submitted, we proceed with the adverse findings. And then the final report will then go through, let's just assume we're making the adverse findings with or without the actual removed allegation, if you've submitted the evidence. In that instance, the roller coaster of approval starts again. So it's still checked and rechecked and resent and checked again and resent until it reaches the public protector, who does the same, makes inputs, discussed, and then once we are happy that, okay, we are, the product is ready, it is then issued.
Yes.
That is the end of the investigation.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That sounds like, I don't know, a military operation. But, you know, we talk so much about all these mechanical things. And I think we forget to be human. So let me ask you this. At a human level, how does it feel for you, having put yourself through all this, what you've described now in detail, having had a page, a letter like this, going up and down, being corrected, recorrected, and all sorts of things, but the pain of trying to be fair to the people who might have adverse findings. And then to get, you know, people who probably would not even be able to put a 5-page letter of this kind of complexity. Or let me maybe just say, how does it feel when somebody like Ms. Mazzoni, MP, then say reduces all this to, you were just going through the motions because you just wanted to, you had a vendetta against Mr. Godan. So all this was just play and pretense.
It's offensive, as I stated, of even the allegation that I was involved in a conspiracy or vendetta against a person I don't know personally. And really my integrity as an investigator for all these years, how many investigations have I conducted and what made him that special? So it is offensive and it's not appreciated. But like you said, they don't work at the public protector, so they'll never know what it is.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that. And just the, you know more than all of us sitting here, how much the public protector herself now puts into something like this. You've described the drafts going to her, coming back, going to her, coming back, having discussions, and what have you. In your experience, would what you observed in this particular case and how much work was done, knowing that particularly EMEA investigations have to invariably been done under pressure. What do you say about the suggestion that she did not do any of this, or she did not do it genuinely, and she was just out to lynch an innocent Mr. Godan, Mr. Pillay, Mr. Mahashul?
I would say, from my experience and what I was exposed to during the time I worked with her during this investigation, I never had any doubt that there were media reports, of course, that came out alleging Mr. Godan would say there's someone on a witch hunt for him, etc. But I never experienced that kind of behavior from her. She didn't at any point try to influence us to say that we must make a finding against Mr. Godan and we must ignore certain evidence so that we can make a finding. It's sad.
It's very sad. Thank you. And on that sad note, then Mr. Godin, actually, we said earlier that he's the source of why we're here, although he's been shielded from coming to substantiate it here. But we have to defend ourselves against his non-appearance or not having the conviction of and the courage to come here and face the committee to substantiate this. But among the things that he claimed, if we can go back to the Mr. Godin's response to the Section 7-9, which you'll find at 5931, I think, of bundle F, item 190. This is really what brings us here, and obviously he then expanded on this in his court papers, and then the judge is found in his favor. Hence we're here. Go to the last page, 5952. After giving the explanation, which is it's about 21 pages. At page 23, this is the conclusion that Mr. Godin then reaches, which brings us here, as I say. The public protector's proposed findings against me substantiating complaints laid by my political opponents are unfounded and are explicable only by bias or ulterior motive. I call on her to reconsider the true facts and the applicable law and find that I am innocent of any wrongdoing. Let's put aside the fact that he's not prepared to come here to do so. But what do you have to say that all the work that you had put in can be explicable only by bias or ulterior motives?
Like I previously said, Mr. Boff, there were no elements of bias or ulterior motive that I saw or received from the public protector. That's why I always question a statement like this. Okay, does he have proof that we had ulterior motives? An email saying that I wanted to persecute him for something? Because, no, I don't agree with the statement. My work was not biased and or had any ulterior motives towards Mr. Godin.
Yes. And paragraph 51 of the same document, going backwards, Tepo. He says, the establishment of the unit was perfectly lawful. You obviously have said that you don't agree with that, correct?
That's correct.
And then here's the important part. The public protector's proposed findings to the contrary are wholly unjustified, erroneous, and intended to serve a political purpose or other ulterior motive. What do you have to say about that? And that's really the gist of the charges 11.3 and 11.4, that for political purposes, she chose her favorites, Mahashule and Zwane, for being spared of any adverse finding, and targeted her alleged opponents, Ramaphosa and Godin, to serve a political or ulterior purpose. Is there any basis for those charges or this accusation?
On our side, or on my side, or on PP's side of the court, if I would say so, there wouldn't be any basis on this. Unfortunately, as the public protector, South Africa, We don't choose who walks into our doors and complains. So I think he said the statement on the basis that Mr. Shivambu belongs to the EFF and there's a political opponent of the ANC. However, even with that knowledge, we can't stop an investigation because the complainant is from an opposition party. There was no political purpose. There was no political motive to discredit him. It was just about a truth-finding mission of a complaint that we had received.
Yes. And let's suppose for a minute that Mr. Shivambu had a political motive.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the issue. The issue is whether you and the public protector and the people in your team then, as it were, embraced that political motive and did anything unprofessional, dishonest or biased in order to pursue it?
No, none of those happened, and we did not embrace any political issues.
Yes. And in any event, if that this is to be taken to its logical conclusion, it would mean we must repeal EMIA. We must not have such an act, because the chances are that it says it must always, the complainant must always be a member of parliament. Mm-hmm. And at least with the current legal system or political system in South Africa, those people who are members of parliament are always members of political parties, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
And the parliament, in its wisdom, knowing that all members of parliament are members of political parties, allowed that the public protector must act in terms of an EMIA investigation only on the basis of a complaint by such a political person, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And as we have established, all EMIA investigations, including the current Palapala one, emanate from a member of a political party, correct?
As far as I'm aware, yes. Unfortunately, I'm not involved in that investigation and never even seen the complaint form, so I'm not sure if, but media statements have stated that.
Yes. No, but even if you've never seen it, if I tell you that it's an EMIA investigation, then automatically it means it would have emanated from a political,
yes,
a member of a political party. You may not know who that is, but it would have to be a member of a political party.
Yes,
right?
That is true.
And by the way, EMIA investigations such as that Palapala one would have to take about 30 days, correct? In terms of the law, as supposed to take 30 days.
Yes, in terms of the act.
Yes, and we know, I think evidence has been given here that it's usually difficult to achieve that depending on the complexity of the matter. So it might take 3 months, 4 months, depending on the complexity of the issues, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
But if the issues are straightforward and seemingly, and I know that they might look straightforward to the naked eye, can it take longer? Can it take like 9 months, 12 months, 2 years? Or do you, maybe let me ask it like this. Is it the culture within the public protector that such investigations, particularly ones that are important to the public, like this one, would have to be prioritized? And even if you miss the 30 days, that it should not be too far, correct?
Yes, especially with EMIA investigations.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Now, let me, while we are in this document, Chair, sorry, just for the sake of completion, I found something that I had been looking for earlier. Paragraph 26. Sorry. Okay. Now, this is Mr. Khodan under oath in his own words. The Mr. Khodan that we are told is irrelevant to this commission, to this committee. Actually saying the following. Let's go to paragraph 22. Sorry. During my tenure as Commissioner of SARS, I authorized the establishment of an investigation unit in about 2007. The unit did not initially have a name, but it was later successively known as the Special Project Unit, the National Research Group, and the High Risk Investigation Unit. I shall call it the unit. So on Mr. Khodan's own version, he agrees that he established the unit, correct?
Yes.
So the only issue then would be the issues that we have already discussed as to whether that was knowingly illegal as indicated in the letter to Mr. Manuel and all that. I won't go back to that. I just wanted to establish the fact that he says he established it himself, correct?
Yes, a unit.
Yes. The unit. With all the different names, Special Projects Unit, the NRG and High Risk Investigating Unit, which he says, I shall call it the unit. Okay?
Yes.
Yeah. And then at paragraph 26, he says, yeah. And this is the important part. That's the issue I was talking, they say in law at least, or even in logic, a small word like the or a, the difference between that can make all the difference with all these piles and piles of paper. This is what he says, and you must look at the last sentence where he used the word the unit. Listen carefully. Mr. Khodan says under oath, it became apparent to SARS, this is now after the Trevor Manuel
memo,
yeah. It became apparent to SARS that it had to enhance its capacity to gather information of and investigate organized crime, right? It, that is SARS, decided in or about February 2007 to set up the unit to penetrate and intercept, okay, the activities of tax and customs related crime syndicates. So he admits that it was necessary to intercept, among other things, which is what we discussed earlier, correct?
Correct.
And which we know would have required the approval of a judge in South Africa, at least, correct?
Well, we would need to check if the Interception of Communication Act was in effect in 2007.
Yes, I think it was. I think it's 2002, but assume for now that it was in existence. That would then require the permission of a judge, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And then it says its initial intention, that's the SARS, was to employ and train the members of the unit and then to transfer them to National Intelligence Agency, where they would continue to function as a unit dedicated to SARS. So that's along the lines of his memorandum to Mr. Manuel, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Which said that the reason for him wanting to do that was that they did not have the legal power to do so, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Then he says, the NIA, however, lost appetite for the project, which is understandable. So NIA no longer was playing ball, okay? Here's the important part. It says, SARS accordingly decided to retain the unit within its enforcement division. So this is what I'm saying. So he's still talking about the same unit, which was illegal, which they were going to transfer to NIA to make it legal. And NIA lost appetite. And then SARS accordingly decided to retain the unit within its enforcement decision. This is Mr. Kodan in his own words, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And this seems to accord with your what you said earlier, that the unit never changed its character. It was simply no longer going to be transferred to SARS, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then here's another giveaway. He says that one of the reasons why they wanted to the approval of the Minister of Finance was because, I suppose, let's call it PFMA compliance, because the unit would have involved transfer of funds from SARS to NIA.
Yes.
Yes. So he then explains that that transfer of funds was no longer going to happen. Hence, they no longer needed this approval, but says nothing about the illegality, the fact that it was still illegal for a different purpose. Let's go to paragraph 32. Okay. This plan required the approval of the Minister of Finance only because, I'm sorry, 31. This plan required the approval of the Minister of Finance only because it would involve a transfer of funds from SARS to the NIA. Now, you'll remember, if you don't know this, don't worry, because we'll converse it with the PP. At some stage, there was approval needed from the Minister of Finance on the one hand, but also the Minister of Intelligence. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
So let's accept what Mr. Kodan is saying here for a minute and say, therefore, the approval as far as the transfer of funds would be acquired from the Minister of Finance, but the approval to cure the illegality would be acquired from the Minister of Intelligence.
Yes, that's right. True.
Yes. Now, he obtained the approval for the finance, but he did not obtain the approval from the Minister of Intelligence to cure the illegality, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. And yet, this is what he says at paragraph 32. As explained above, the NIA, however, lost appetite for the project, so he never received the approval from NIA, and decided not to proceed with it. That's common cause, okay? And then he says, SARS consequently decided to keep the unit in SARS. This change of plan did not require fresh ministerial consent because it no longer involved the transfer of funds from SARS to the NIA. Now, that's what I call an exercise in obfuscation. So assume he's right that the financial transfers are no longer going to happen, but he's also conceding that the NIA approval to cure the illegality was never obtained, correct?
Yes, but he puts it now as a loss of interest.
Yes. Well, whatever. Mm. Loss of interest, immigration, whatever the reason was. But the point is that he did not get the approval to cure the illegality, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then it says at 34, this is the punchline. I accordingly participated in the approval of the project for the establishment of the unit. I was, however, not involved in the practicalities of the establishment of the unit and never played any part in the conduct and management of its operation. Again, let's be fair to Mr. Kodan, even if he doesn't want to come here and face the music, that he didn't participate in the actual bagging of people and surveillance and so on. You never found him guilty of that, did you?
No.
But what you did found him responsible for is what he admits here, which is he accordingly participated in the approval of the project for the establishment of the unit.
Yes.
Thank you. And then at 35, she says, I believed that the unit was lawfully established to perform very important functions for and on behalf of SARS. As far as I was aware, it lawfully performed its functions. If any of its members engaged in improper and or unlawful activities, then they did so without my knowledge or consent. Again, let's be fair to Mr. Khotan, even though he doesn't want us to come here. Let's assume the unlawful activities happened without his knowledge. That's not what you are accusing of. It was the establishment of the unit, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And in any event, in our law, does it matter what he believed or did not believe? He says, I believe that the unit was lawfully established to perform a very important functions for and on behalf of SARS. Is the test of whether there is a breach of statute or the PFMA objective or subjective? In other words, if I breach the PFMA thinking that I did not breach it, does that make the breach any lesser?
I know.
And the public protector agrees, and the KPMG, and Sikakane, and the Inspector General, and Brassi, and Trenkove, and Kruan, and anybody with even half a brain would agree that the test, one who's not even a lawyer, that the test for breaches of PFMA is objective. In other words, if an official buys 20 buses when he's only entitled to buy 10 buses, whether he believed or he couldn't read properly doesn't matter, even if he genuinely believed he was entitled thereto, correct?
That's correct.
So on this version of Mr. Khotan, by himself under oath, signed before some commissioner of oaths, known as Mr. Peter Jonathan Ivex or whatever in Cape Town on the 20th of June 2019. On this version of his, would he have been, would the findings of maladministration in respect of the establishment of the unit have been established?
Yes, he's been admitting that
rogue,
he was...
Sorry, there's interference from the rogue unit. Can you start again? You're saying he's basically...
Admitting that he was involved in the establishment of the unit. If you can read it carefully, it says that he was involved in the establishment and he knew that it would have been an intelligence unit because that was written in the memo, 2007.
And does the fact that Ms. Mazzoni and the rest of them say that this is proof of you and the public protectors vendetta against Mr. Khotan, can it stand any scrutiny in the light of what Mr. Khotan says now? Forget about what the public protector says, forget about what anyone else says, of what Mr. Khotan says in his own affidavit.
Can you please repeat the question?
Is there, therefore, based on what Mr. Khotan says in his own affidavit in response to your Section 7-9 letter, your detailed Section 7-9 letter, would there have been any room for anyone to say that faced with this response, which is really basically amounts to a confession, that you should have then changed your provisional findings and now find all of a sudden that Mr. Khotan was no longer responsible for the unlawful establishment of the unit?
No, I don't believe so.
Yes. In other words, what I'm really asking you is, we've gone through the journey of what Section 7-9 is meant to do, what the opportunity it gives to a person. And by the way, is it correct that when you sent the Section 7-9, Mr. Khotan asked for an extension. I would too, by the way, faced with such a complex letter. But then he asked for more time for him to give the response, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Did the public protector grant him such an extension?
Yes. Even in his first submission, he was granted an extension.
Yes. And once he was satisfied that he had had enough time that to deal with all the accusations, what he gave you is what amounted to a confession of illegality, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Chair, I'm not by any means finished, but...
Fortunately, your time is finished. And that's the difference in the way we operate.
I know, Chair.
I'd like you to wrap up, please.
I'm asking for time, yes. Chair, I'm going to wrap up, Chair, I promise. I just have maybe three or four topics. I'll do them as quickly as possible. What I wanted to get an indication from you was whether I think I need about an hour, whether you want to give it to me now or tomorrow morning.
We'll do it now.
Okay, Chair. I won't use it all up, I promise, if I can. Okay, thank you. All right, let's go back to the famous judgment that brought us here. So you'll find that at page 4118 of the of that bundle of judgments. So I can't remember what it is now. But it's paragraph 200, I think, or no, 290 of the judgment.
The simple food, which judgment are you wanting to go to?
Okay, the one and only so-called rogue unit judgment.
Hold on, bundle 319.
Yes, I think it's bundle C. Sorry. Yeah, it's bundle 3, bundle C number 3, judgment 18, something like that. That's how Advocate Power identified it earlier. We just dealt with it now about the matric certificate.
Which paragraph?
Yes. Oh, sorry. I didn't say that it was up here. Yeah, it is that paragraph, 290. Thanks, Chair. Yes, this paragraph really summarizes why we're here, why the judges found it necessary to make the conclusion of bias and dishonesty. So they say correctly that if you have findings of bias and dishonesty, assuming that those are justified, that this was then justified an inference of bias. So they say, paragraph 290, we have already alluded throughout the judgment why we say that the public protector has not only failed in the exercise of her duties, but displayed bias towards Minister Godan and Mr. Pillay. So we conclude that taking into account the following conclusion, rather the following comma, a conclusion of bias is warranted. Then they list the things, some of which we have, you and I have discussed and shown to be, to have no foundation either in fact or in law. But let's go through them. The first one is something where you and I have not discussed, and since we don't have time, I'll only spend 5 minutes on it. They say that the investigation fell outside the jurisdiction of the public protector as it relates to events dating back to 2010. No exceptional circumstances have been presented by the public protectors of filing an investigation after an extraordinary lapse of time. Also, despite that fact, the previous incumbent has already in 2014 received a complaint about the alleged unlawful establishment of the unit, but elected not to investigate the complaint. Public protector proceeded with the investigation. Firstly, is this factually true? Let's not start with the facts. Let's start with the law. In your experience, and hopefully Advocate Matt Donsela will assist us in this as well. In your experience, was there a blanket prohibition against doing investigations when the matter was more than 2 years old?
No.
And whose decision was it, or how did it work that such a matter would be considered?
The termination of the jurisdiction is based on the public protector applying her discretion.
Mm-hmm.
At the time when this investigation started, and in some instances that delegation is or the discretion is delegated to the intake and assessment unit, who then makes a determination of whether the matter falls within or without the two-year rule, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
So if they determine that it is 2 years and older, then they will then take a decision of whether or not to proceed with the investigation. So at the time, the decision to accept the complaint, because if the decision, the jurisdiction is applied strictly by intake and assessment, the complaint would not have been accepted.
Uh-huh.
But now it was accepted basically on the basis that we've never not investigated two-year-old matters unless it's a pre-1994 matter. But if, let me say 95, but if the public protector or the units that I mentioned is satisfied that there's merit to the complaint, the possibility of investigating, finding the information still exists, the public protector will continue to investigate. So jurisdiction is not taken away because the matter is older than 2 years.
Oh, okay.
From our understanding, though, when we started the investigation, the courts have found otherwise, of course. So
yeah. Thank you. Yes, subsequently. In fact, yes. To be fair to the courts, they said, I think in the Pillay judgment, at the beginning of that judgment, the court says that it's the first time that Section 6(9) of the Public Prosecutor Act, which is the one that you've just paraphrased, was being considered by the courts. But obviously this was, in fact, that's referred to in this judgment as well, because those two judgments came around the same time. Chair, okay, I'll find the reference. But anyway, I know because I argued that point in both matters. But long and short of it is, yes, you're right. Until that point, it had never been considered by the courts. It was considered in those two cases and then in the GEMS case as well. Whether the two-year rule was, as the court interpreted it rightly or wrongly, was a prescription kind of thing, which says 2 years, otherwise you cannot investigate. Or whether, which is what the public protector argued, it was all actually, because it is found in Section 6, which gives the wide powers of the public protector, it was a permissive section, which says if the public protector thinks that a matter is important enough, whether it's 200 years old and the evidence is still there, then, and she feels that it is important, then in her discretion, it can be
investigated,
yes.
Yes, that's how
it had been approached until that point, yeah. Okay. So, if then that's how it had been approached up to that point by all the public protectors before, could that then be an indication of bias?
I won't know about all the other public protectors, how they applied or interpreted 6(9). But in under the two that I've worked under, mm-hmm. No, it would not.
Okay, who are those two?
Advocate Mrs. Siyam Kwebane and Advocate Tulima Denzel.
Right, thank you. And anyway, the proof of that fact is even in this paragraph. It says in 2014, the former public protector of Madonsela, because that was her time, received a complaint and elected not to investigate the complaint about the unit. But this public protector nonetheless proceeded with the investigation. Firstly, was that factually true? Was the complaint, the earlier complaint about the establishment of the unit, to your knowledge?
I believe it was one of the allegations, but I'll have to go back and check the closing report. But what is elected not to investigate. She might have elected not to investigate because and claim when stated from the report that I saw when I was watching Mr. Matabu,
uh-huh.
That the reasoning for not investigating that portion of the investigation was due to the fact that the OIGI and the NPA had already either began their investigations or were busy with the investigations.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's fine. Mr. Matabuche, Advocate Matanzela, hopefully will clarify that. But the point is that, the point is that even by 2014, that the establishment of the unit was already more than 2 years old, correct?
Yes, that's true.
Right. Okay. The next one, then they say that the manner in which Mr. Pablo Pereira interacted with Minister Kodan during the investigation, this in the report, not only did Pablo Pereira elect not to engage with Minister Kodan's attorneys on record, the Section 79 notice was publicly posted on YouTube before giving any notice to him, his attorneys. Similarly, the report was presented to the media without any prior notice to Minister Kodan or his legal representatives. Okay, all of which is will be dealt with by the public protector in her evidence. But for your part, you've already answered this, that you put blood and sweat in ensuring, and the public protector, in ensuring that the Section 79 was as detailed as humanly possible and as fair as possible, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And actually, is this also factually correct? Does the public protector ever publish Section 79 notices on YouTube or anywhere?
None that I know of.
Yeah.
No.
Remember when I read it out to you, the last paragraph says that even the person receiving the 79 is not allowed to share the contents thereof with any person. Correct?
Yes, it's confidential.
Let alone the public protector, who then issues that warning, and then she goes and puts it on YouTube. Anyway. All right. Then, on number three, they say the reliance on the discredited KPMG report, despite having been disavowed, and Skakane report, despite it having been widely discredited. Well, we've gone through this. There's no substance in the Skakane report being widely discredited. And the KPMG report, we did not go through it in detail, but I will deal with it maybe with Mr. Matabuge. You can take it from me that it was not totally disavowed, but part of it. The KPMG basically said that they relied on counsel's advice without having verified that advice. But you don't have to worry about this. But the Skakane report being widely discredited, do you know, have any knowledge of that?
No, I do not.
Oh. And then it says, she also fails to engage with the findings made in the Nugent report. Is that possibly true?
No, that's incorrect.
We demonstrated earlier that the new public protector quoted the Nugent report in the letter to Mr. Kodan. She quoted it in the letter to Mr. Pillay, and I'm sure in the letter to SARS, and that she even quoted it in the final rogue unit report, correct?
That's correct.
And then number four, it says the blatant dishonesty of the public protector with regard to the OIGI report and her insistence on ordering Minister of State Security to implement in totality a report that she has, according to the report, never seen. Well, we know that this one is an absurdity because she never claimed in the report that she never saw the OIGI report. We dealt with that before lunchtime, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then number five, it says the public protector pandering of the rogue unit narrative and her public reference to the unit as a rogue unit and as a monster and her stated desire to defeat the monster displays profound bias towards Minister Kodan and Minister Pillay. Well, firstly, I think you and I have established that when the term so-called rogue unit was coined in the KPMG and Skakane reports, the public protector was busy working in China and not involved in any of these matters, correct?
Yes, the term was not created by her.
Yes. And in any event, this is also factually not true. You can take it from me and my learned friend, Ms. Bauer, will object if I'm correct. In the article that was referred to, or rather the speech which was read here during Mr. Van Lochenberg's evidence, actually the public prosecutor referred to this thing as the so-called rogue unit in that speech. So, and that term, so-called rogue unit, was it also her invention?
No, not that I know of.
Right. And her evidence will be that the monster that needs to be defeated was a monster of corruption, but you don't have to comment on that. She will deal with it herself. Then number six is the public protector's complete disregard of the Sunday Times apology and the Kroon apology. We've gone through that. The so-called Kroon apology was for Judge Kroon himself, not the panel, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And the Sunday Times apology, well, what can I say? All right. So, and the public protector was now supposed to alter a report because the Sunday Times has decided to retract something. Is that how you work?
No.
Yeah. And then it says the public protector's scurrilous allegations that Minister Godin deliberately misled. Well, this is wrong grammatically. He probably wanted to say misled. Deliberately misled Parliament. But forget the grammar. Let's just you don't know, or rather, you know about that allegation, but we have not gone through it. That's the allegation about the meeting with the Guptas and so on.
Okay. Yes, I know about the allegation.
Yeah. And in your assessment, and I won't go into detail because of time, was that allegation also substantiated that Mr. Godin, let's say, was not forthcoming about his meeting with the Gupta brothers?
Yes, it was substantiated.
Yeah. Okay. And then the public protector's unwarranted and slanderous attack on Judge Potterill J. She'll deal with that. This is that whole confusion about whether it was the 2000 code or the 2007 code. Don't worry about that. Then the public protector's relentless pandering of untruths of Mr. Pillay's qualification. We've dealt with this one. Did the public protector pander untruths of Mr. Pillay's qualification to your knowledge?
No, not to my knowledge.
Right. So that's why we're here. Because of these findings, none of which you have found to be congruent with the actual situation, to put it nicely, except for the one. Yes, the one that I said you must not. Let's say eight of the nine, you, in your experience, were not a correct basis for the finding of bias, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Then there was a whole thing. We don't have time to deal with it in detail. I might also deal with it with Mr. Mataboga. There's a suggestion that the public protector or you or Mr. Mataboga or your team ignored. Okay. Okay, I think that I'm being intercepted.
Apologies, somebody was switching on. Please continue.
Okay, 2%. Those people, are they properly employed by Parliament?
It's not official.
Okay.
It could be one of the members. I think by mistake they would have.
Oh, yes. I see. Okay. We are worried these days. Yeah. Okay. Now,
the proper explanation is that there's somebody who dressed that was watching TV at the same time.
Oh.
On 4-0.
Then there's an echo.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you, Chair. It's better than what we saw last week on the screen. But Yes. This is what the court says at 293. The public protector's bias against Mr. Godin and Mr. Play is manifest, having regard to the manner in which the public protector simply dismissed out of hand, completely ignored and irrationally discarded the hard facts and clear evidence. It is clear that she approached her investigation with a preconceived notion, determined to make an adverse finding against Minister Godin and Mr. Pillay, thereby promoting the false rogue unit narrative. So you see now here, this is a mirror of charge number 11.3 and 11.4. So it means you, Mr. Matabuha, the public protector, what discarded hard facts and clear evidence because you were chasing a preconceived notion and determined to make adverse findings against Mr. Godin and Mr. Pillay, thereby promoting the false rogue unit narrative. That's what the charges said. Is there any substance to this?
No. Which discarded hard evidence and... I don't know. Have you moved the paragraph?
Oh, sorry. Careful. It goes to the next page. Yeah. I'll read it again because it's quite a serious accusation. It is clear that she and you and others approached your investigation with a preconceived notion. Oh, no. Sorry. Let's start with the evidence. Blah, blah, blah. Simply dismissed out of hand and completely ignored and irrationally discarded hard facts and clear evidence. Supposed to the contrary. And anything like that?
No.
Anyway, so it goes. That's fine. Then I'll move because of time to another topic. But maybe before I do that, let me just quickly deal with there's another quick accusation, for lack of a better word, that is bandied about against the public protector, but I won't spend time on that because I think even witnesses that were clearly hostile and biased against her considered the point. But just for the sake of completion, the public protector has been accused of all these horrific things, among other things, because of information that may or may not have found itself in Rule 53 records. Remember that?
I think so, but that accusation.
Mm.
Yes.
Okay. Now, can you explain why that accusation is baseless?
Towards the public protector?
Yes.
The public protector is not involved in putting together the Rule 53.
Mm-hmm.
All documents and evidence is mostly with us, except certain recordings, which in this case was the SSA meetings and the minister meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Those we had to request directly from Ephraim, the PA. But documents that were in our possession were all compiled into the Rule 53.
Yes. I think, okay, so for the sake of time, I'll just read out paragraph 44 of your statement at page 462 of the statement, Chair. Say, I can confirm that the public protector had nothing whatsoever to do with the compilation of Rule 53 records. That task is not even performed at the level of the executive manager. It is performed by the investigator, that would be someone like you, as the person on the ground with the assistance of the legal department or the external attorneys. Is that how it works at PPSA?
Yes, the investigator leading the investigation is the one who compiles the Rule 53.
Yes.
So if a particular Rule 53 record, because of either you or the attorneys or the internal legal department, did not contain one document or another, could that be a basis for impeaching the public protector?
No. I mean, as we've said, there's human error in every situation. Even I was assisted, the amount of documents that were there. So if it did happen that a document was missing, it would not fall on the public protector. The external attorneys as well would have had to request it, etc. So through the legal department, but the PP, no.
Yeah. Okay, let's take it to absurd length and say that either the external attorneys or the internal attorneys or yourself or somebody in that process, not by human error, but deliberately, one of them decided to take out a particular document. Could that be ascribed to the public protector if she doesn't participate in that process?
No, she doesn't even see the Rule 53 or confirm that it's been sent to the legal department or check the documents that are submitted, etc.
Yeah.
So she wouldn't have had access to it.
Thank you. All right. Okay. Now, then, you then say at paragraph 42 and 41, and I think it's important to read this. You've said it in different ways today, but I just want to put it in your own words in this statement. Yes. See, I'm starting at 41. The public protector plays no role. No active role during the investigation, as I have demonstrated above, even at the assessment of the merit of the complaint. I myself, a person who investigated and produced the report, had no relationship or sympathies with Mr. Shivam, with the complainant. He was treated like any other complainant. The public protector did not interfere with the investigation, neither did she try to influence the outcome of the investigation, including the findings as contained in the report. Now, please explain this, because very briefly, it's another gray area. We know, as you've said repeatedly and other witnesses, that, as you said, documents go up to the public protector, documents come down. Sometimes she issues instructions, do this, do that, or give deadlines in dashboard meetings or whatever. But apart from that supervisory role, does the public protector actually play any role in the actual investigation? In other words, in evidence gathering, phoning SARS, and this one and that one?
No, she does not.
Okay. And then you also say, sorry. And in situations where, I'll deal with Mr. Matabuha for lack of time. In situations where the public protector receives, and I'm sure all public protectors receive, information on a daily basis from citizens, all sorts of whistleblowers and so on, what does she normally do with that information?
It's in this case or in general?
In general. And in this case.
Okay, in this case, information was filtered through Mr. Matabuhle.
Mm-hmm.
In general, it's sent to Ephraim, who then ascertains who is responsible for that particular matter, and the information is handed over to the relevant investigator of the matter.
Yes, and thank you. Well, there was even a suggestion made here last week that there was a document which was read, I think it's at page 5978, where it is said that somebody wrote that Mr. Godin must be, I don't know what, must be stopped with all sorts of political reasons why that was so, but white monopoly capital and what have you. Yeah. And the public protector, 5978, okay, thank God I remembered the page. Okay, then just go to that. At the top, Pravin Gordhan is a threat to democracy and must be stopped before he causes more harm under the guise of cleaning up, and so on and so on. Now, the evidence of the public protector will be that that is something that was sent to her by a whistleblower or by whoever sent it, but someone who did not want to be identified. And as you say, then she would transmit it to the team.
Mm.
Is that a usual process, procedure?
Yeah, it depends what the email was about. Besides threat to democracy, I think there are various matters that are discussed in this complaint that were being investigated at the time. Mm. So the same procedure goes to the relevant chief investigator, or through Ephraim, then either through the assistance of intake and assessment will find out which matters belong to which investigator, and then the information is dispersed. But I've never seen this email, so
yeah.
I won't necessarily know what happened to the information contained in it.
Yes. Okay, let's go to the beginning of that email. Okay, it's that. The email is dated 8 November 2018 to Rodney from the public protector, and it says, some information for investigation BBND. What was BBND?
It's an investigation against SARS relating to the appointment or the alleged irregular appointment of a company called Baron Badge and Doran, so abbreviated BBND.
Yes. And then you can see that the email, it just starts in 2001. There's no greeting, no reference to any person. Just as in 2001, the former minister, Jeff Khadebe, wrote a scathing letter to Coleman Andrews, what have you, and so on. In your experience, is that how the public protector would write her emails, just without any preface?
No, and she likes summarizing, so this is very detailed when she's passing on information directly to you. This is like someone telling a story.
Yeah. Well, okay, because we don't have time, I won't go through the detail, but this, just go further down. It refers to something called the Nugget Commission. And at the Nugget Commission.
Nugent, I think.
It's Nugget, according to this person. Did the public protector not know that the commission was by Nugent and not Judge Nugget, whoever that is?
I believe she would have known.
Yeah. Okay, anyway. It raised and raised. The difficulty with this is that we actually have another email, which, Chair, if with your permission, I'll refer to it in re-examination, which is similar. The only difference is that one, the person is identified. And in fact, the public protector's evidence is going to be that in that one, she simply forgot to remove the person's name because she And so we will, when we play it, it will be...
Is that an email that we have seen already or received?
You have received.
You'll only introduce it in 10.
No. It's in the package chair. The reason why I'm saying this is because I'm in a dilemma. I could display it now, but then I'll be disclosing the person's name. But in fact, it's my fault. What I had intended to do was to redact the name so that it can be done here. But we didn't do that, yeah. But it is in the package, too, yeah. Anyway, I think the point is made for now. If there's no objection, then we will play that, or rather display that other image. But the point really is that if you look at this, and you've already commented about the style and the misspelling of Charles Nugent and all those things, in your knowledge of communications with the public protector, is this something that would be coming from her in your experience?
No, this comes from a complainant. We receive a lot of these. Once the complainants find out that we are investigating certain matters, because I see Bain & Co. was also one of the allegations that were made. And then, SAA, I don't know anything about. And Mango, no. But the way that the email is detailed, it sounds like it comes from a complainant.
Yeah.
It's detailed and no offense all over the place.
Thank you. Yes, and then I think there was another embarrassing confusion which you can help us with. There was a suggestion, well, I don't know if it was persisted with, but there was an email which referred to ACE, and it was suggested that there might be Ace Makhashule. At the public protector, ACE and ACOO, what do those abbreviations stand for?
ACOO is Acting Chief Operations Officer. ACE would be Acting Chief Executive.
Thank you.
So either Executive Manager, they have that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Now, I think that was made clear, but I mean, it just shows you the kinds of things that we get subjected to. But then the last point before I run out of time is, I just want to read this out as well. You say, blah, 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 blah. But paragraph 42, I'm also not aware of any decision taken by the public protector or the chief investigator, which was not based on an honest opinion and unsupported by the facts. Do you stand by that? That's paragraph 42.
Yes, I stand by it.
And then you also say, I never got any impression of any undue influence by the public protector, neither did I get an impression that she was forcing the team towards a particular outcome. Do you stand by that?
Yes, I do.
And then I'm jumping 40. Oh, no, let me not jump it. Paragraph 45, you say, it is therefore my testimony that the allegations contained in charges 11.3 and or 11.4 of the charge sheet have no factual or evidential basis insofar as they relate to the so-called rogue unit investigation and report, which was conducted honestly and impartially, irrespective of whether one agrees or disagrees with the findings and or remedial action. Neither did the public protector nor any of her subordinates involved in the matter, including me, acted improperly or maliciously or even negligently in carrying out our respective official duties. The allegations to the contrary made by Mr. Godin and the others were therefore unfounded. And then you say, it is therefore clear that the factual basis, plural, of the judicial criticism which led to these charges cannot survive a proper and impartial inquiry. Do you stand by that?
Can it is FOPM.
In other words, what we've gone through, the factual basis, not the legal basis, the factual basis, and the other paragraph deals with whether you had malicious intent. You stand by the denial of those?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
If the impartial inquiry takes into evidence what I've presented.
It means impartial inquiry, in other words, without, a fair inquiry, maybe. Let's put it like that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Now, the last issue, I have 7 minutes, so we're going to go very quickly through this. The last section deals with what I called charge number 10. That's the issues to do with human resources transgressions. You remember the harassment, victimization, intimidation, and so on.
Yes, I'm aware of the charge.
Since you are here and you are an employee, we'd like to assist the committee insofar as you have any experience in this. Yeah. Maybe I'll just read your evidence to save time, and then you can comment. Okay.
Okay.
At paragraph 47, you say, to the extent that the public protector, the CEO and COO, and some of the executive managers all demanded extra effort and or performance from investigators to achieve the good outcomes which were achieved, this was not done in any manner which was calculated to be undignified or disrespectful of any person. Do you stand by that, or do you want to explain?
No, I stand by that. I don't need to explain. Excellent. I think this was, there's no explanation needed. There was, people treated me specifically with respect all the time. She listened to opinions and gave input. So, I've never seen her disrespect someone or hear her disrespect someone as well.
Yes.
So I can stand by that.
Yes. And Mr. Mataboge's evidence was that when there were differences of opinions and debates, sometimes she would give in to the opinion of yourselves and other persons. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have.
Thank you. Okay, then the next one at 48, it says, I also wish to confirm categorically that the vast majority of the deadlines which were being monitored in meetings such as Dashboard, which I also attended, were self-imposed by the persons being monitored. In respect of every investigation, the very first set of deadlines are contained in an investigation plan in which all the deadlines are populated by the author of the plan and not imposed from outside or above. Okay, this is quite important. Briefly, what is an investigation plan?
It's a plan on how your investigation will proceed.
Mm-hmm.
It will set out the basic details of the file number, date received, whether or not it's a SEM matter, an EMEA matter, mm-hmm. the allegations, and then the steps that you're going to do in the investigation. So communicate with your complainant. I'll just summarize. It can be a long list or it can be a short, depending on the complexity of the investigation.
Yes.
It will include who you need to write to, who you need to have meetings with, who you have to interview. It will have your risk factors as well,
That's fine. That's enough.
Basically,
enough.
A plan.
We actually have, if I had time, I would display one, but we don't have. But for the purposes of the present, the gist.
Displaying that one? Do you mind displaying
that
one?
Oh, thank you, Chair. Okay, now I've just been given, it's going to take us about an hour to do so. I'm joking. Thank you.
He was advocate and Paul was doing that.
Okay, well,
sorry. Oh, I thought you were helping me to find it.
I am endeavoring to do that.
Okay.
Are we talking
Thank
about
you.
The investigative plan for
yeah,
the SARS
any,
unit?
Any,
no, no, I'm specifically asking for the SARS unit report because the witness would be able to talk to the very issue before.
Yes, if we've got, yeah, if you've got one, that would be even
well,
a bonus. But I was looking for any...
But we haven't received it, that's why I'm raising it.
No, I'm looking for any investigation plan, in other words, the grid, even if it's plain and unpopulated, yeah. But anyway, if we find it, we find it. Thank you, Chair. I just want, let me not waste time on that. If we find it, we find it. But if we don't, we'll deal with it with Mr. Mateaboge. The point really is not so much the content of the investigation plan. The point I'm driving at is the one that comes from your paragraph 48, namely that an investigation plan is something that you, the investigator, drafts. In other words, you say, I'll do this by such and such a date, I'll do this by such and such a date. And then you go to dashboard or whatever to present your own deadlines. And if you haven't met your own deadlines, then there might be a debate. But the point I want to make is that the original deadlines are self-imposed. Is that correct?
You can switch it on again.
Yes, self-imposed in line with the service standards.
Yes. Oh, yes, of course. You don't just put whatever you like.
Mm.
So if it's a mere investigation, obviously you'll have tighter deadlines and so on and so on.
Mm.
So,
if it's a TGI, it will also have different deadlines. If
yes.
it's a service
yes.
delivery matter, it has different deadlines.
Fair enough. So subject to that qualification, that those deadlines would obviously have to conform with the, what do you call those standards?
With SOPs, standard,
standard operation procedures.
Yes.
But other than that, they are self-imposed, correct?
Yes, after the basics are done. So that would be, which are your 30 days, 5 days, those are standard. Once that those are completed, then you can try to figure out your own timeline in terms of how your investigation will proceed.
Yes, thank
so,
you.
Yeah. That,
no,
like any other plan, though, it does change depending on the circumstances of each matter.
Fair enough. Okay, thanks. Okay, I think that point is made. If you find the prototype plan, we'll display it quickly. All right. And then at 49, you say, even when new deadlines are set following the failure to meet the original ones, these are most invariably done after discussion with the affected investigators or official, and never done in a rude or demeaning manner. The aim in all cases is to assist the public. Do you stand by that?
Yes. Like I said, I can only talk about my experience with the PP. She's never been rude. When I have not met a deadline, the reasoning is suitable or understandable. We talk about a new deadline, what were the challenges, and what's the way moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never experienced such. I've never been in the presence of her doing this to another person as well.
Yes. Okay. And then you say that... this has been your honest and personal experience at the institution. I'm certainly not aware of any culture of prevalence of intimidation, harassment, or victimization in the organization. Do you stand by that?
Yes. The charge was very detailed, though. So, yes.
Yes.
I won't go into detail because some of the things I was not a part of, and other colleagues that may have suffered who did not share such information with me, so I wouldn't know where, for example, Mr. Mashango
yes.
went, etc., all of that.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, so,
no,
but
I
was never intimidated, harassed,
yeah.
or victimized.
Thank you. And you met with the evidence leaders in July or August, and shared your information of mainly some of the issues. We might have dealt with them in more detail now, but some of the issues that were raised with you, you gave information to the evidence leaders, correct?
Yes, information that was in my possession.
Yes. And is there anything that is fundamentally different that you said to them? Let's say then you said, no, we were forced to have a vendetta against Mr. Godin, which is materially different, except for the fact that it might be more detailed now, different from what you have told the committee?
No, it is a long time ago. I won't recall such the detailed conversation that we had, but I don't recall stating those vendettas and having bias and being impartial.
Yes. Okay. Now, we're just rushing for time now. But I'm taking advantage of the chair's limited generosity. I know it's not a lot of it. So bundle H, item 31.2.2, is that form, chair. That,
but a funny way of taking advantage of the limited generosity.
Thank you.
Because it might end.
I know.
Oh, okay.
So it's bundle A, rather, bundle H, item 31.2.2. There's a saying, Chair, that says you must not look a gift horse in the mouth. Just take it as it comes. All right. Yes. Okay. That is, again, don't worry about the detail and what is filled in. It's just to assist the committee to see, because we hear all these terms and we don't know. At least it's better when you have a visual image of what it is. Is that what an investigation plan looks like?
Yes.
Okay, just take us through the, not in detail, of how you, if you got this thing in blank, and now you are the investigator, how would you go about populating it? Take us through in 2 minutes.
Insert the file number, mm-hmm. Insert the complainant's name, If complainant wants to remain anonymous, we include their name, but this document is internal. So even if their name is there, we just put it in brackets that anonymous still.
Okay.
For the institution that is being complained against, the name of the investigator, the date received, as is, as it's written there, that's how you fill it in.
Okay, can you roll it down a bit, Papa? Yes, I'm more interested in the time frames. Yeah. So then, obviously, on the left-hand side, you have actions or things to be done. And the gist of what we were discussing would be on the right-hand side. That would be the deadlines.
Yes.
Or let's call it time frames.
Yes.
Okay. So in this case, if you said action to be taken, decide how to deal with the complaint, provide complainant investigators details, finalize investigation plan 5 to 11 July 2018. Then next.
Yes.
Next one.
This is against SASA. Right?
Yeah.
Time frames will be different. If each point will get a different date, it's not, you can do it like that, or you can actually put each task with its own date.
All right. Okay. So get the idea. Just roll it all, Sapo, further on. Yeah. Okay. And then, right. Then the real big deadline is the last one, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Then duration of the investigation. In other words, you have that deadline and then you work backwards. It is estimated that the investigation will be completed within a period of 24 months from September 2018 to October 2020. So that's your time frame now, the large one, not the specific one. And then it gets signed by, let's say, or you're saying this gets filled by the investigator?
Yes, if seniors report to the chief investigators,
yes.
So it
okay.
will be...
So you as the investigator, you'd have it then signed by your senior investigator and the chief investigator?
Currently, because now investigators do report to senior investigators. Previously, when I was, well, this investigation started specifically, and another colleague that was in GGI as well as an investigator. We reported directly to the chief investigator. Mm. We've never reported to a senior.
Yeah, no, yeah. Just in the normal course of events, or let's say as it happens now, if it was done by an investigator, would it have to go through the normal steps to senior investigator, chief investigator?
You must remember now I'm in the province, so we operate differently in the province. In the province, the senior, it's the investigator and the senior investigator that sign.
Okay, fine. Anyway, let's just say your reporting line would then sign it.
Yes, but your reporting line.
Yeah. The point really is that then this is the blueprint from now on, as far as this investigation is concerned, you will then be judged according to that framework.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Then thank you very much. I don't want to abuse the privilege I've been given by the chair, but I do want to say that I wish, if we had more time, I think your evidence has been most valuable and informative, educational, and hopefully it will assist the committee to resolve some of the allegations that have been made. Thank you very much. And I might ask you one or two things at the end, but that will be on a limited basis, just for clarification. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. I did realize that you have placed a lot of emphasis on this witness and the issues you put, so the extra time is corresponds with that. You had asked for an extra hour.
Thank
and
you,
I've exactly given you that extra hour.
Thank you, sir.
Just to indicate the fairness of the process. Thank you very much. Colleagues,
thank you.
We will pause there for today. Thank you. We'll meet tomorrow at 10. Ms. Mvuyane, please go take a break.
Yes.
And the rest. It was a long day.
Thank you.
We're getting there. Thank you. See you tomorrow. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Ms. Mvuyane.